Got your chair fixed, Judge?
It's going.
Good morning. We have three cases scheduled for oral argument this morning, and we understand counsel have announced ready and declared the amount of time that you wish to take for those arguments. That being the case, we'll call Wanda Bonney and Marvin Bonney versus Edward E. Scott et al.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Dan Foster. I'm here today representing both Marvin Bonney and Wanda Bonney, who are two ex-spouses in this lawsuit. We're challenging the legal and factual sufficiency of the evidence to support the judgment for damages that was awarded on behalf of the plaintiffs for breach of a non-compete agreement and an asset purchase. I kind of imagine this collective groan from the bench when I say that I'm making a legal and factual sufficiency challenge, because I'm sure that the response is, oh, we're going to hear another closing argument from the same attorney. Why should we expect a different result? Why should he expect a different result? And I'm fully aware in challenging the fact finder's determinations that's an uphill battle, but I think we have the law on our side, and you have to have evidence to prove the case. Why do I expect a different result, and why are we in a better position than the trial judge to come to a different conclusion? We have the benefit of a written record to see what was actually said, the words that were actually spoken, as opposed to him relying on his memory as to what he heard during the trial over the course of a day and a half when the points might not have been as precise or cut. Is it the same argument? In essence, it partially is, because I've got to point out the same weaknesses that I did at the trial court level. And I guess focusing first on the two issues that are maybe the easiest to address, as to Marvin Bonney. Judgment was awarded against Marvin Bonney. Marvin is not married to Wanda. There was a divorce sometime well before this action. She kept the name, and they continued to coexist together, and he helped in the business. But as to this particular event, they were not married. And the undisputed testimony, and I think if counsel has a dispute, I'm sure he'll point it out, Marvin Bonney, during the period of time that they're complaining about, was dealing with being diagnosed with prostate cancer and the treatment for same. He had no contact or very little contact with the business during this point in time. He did not hire Donna Thorley, who is the person they're complaining about, and he did not earn any profits. Yet the court awarded the judgment against him, too, the same as Wanda. Also, as to Computax, the LLC entity, they were thrown in. There are no pleadings to support it. There's no theory to support the award of a judgment in favor of the entity. The only parties to this should be, at this point, the plaintiffs individually and Wanda Bonney. As to Wanda, and I'll kind of deal with the facts at the same time as the argument, because it is the factual argument. There was testimony that all three, Marvin, Wanda, and Donna, had substantial experience in the fast tax preparation business. They'd been doing it for a number of years. They had a relationship. They were doing it at least two locations, Meadowbrook and Woodhaven. Plaintiffs negotiated to purchase one of those locations, and that's what this case is about. At the time Mr. Scott negotiated, although he was a CPA, he obviously had less experience in the business, no experience really in the fast tax business. At the time of trial, his fast tax experience was doing approximately 10 returns the previous year, which was the first year that he owned the business at issue. And looking at it, we got to compare year one, and I'm not going to use tax years because it gets confusing, because 2005 tax year actually occurs in 06. 06 tax year occurs in 07, and it's easy to get those dates confused, so I'm just going to refer to it as year one and year two. First year that he purchased the business, he conducted the same business in the same location, and most importantly, he had the same employee, Donna Thorley, who did it 240 of, I think, approximately 300 returns, by far the vast majority of the returns that were done. In that year, of the 369 people on the original list that were essentially sold to Mr. Scott, 170 chose to go somewhere else. Many of the factors the same, most of the business the same, a vast, substantial portion of the people went to another location. There was testimony that some of the changes in the business that Mr. Scott attempted to do could have been detrimental to a fast tax business, the way he operated the business. Year two, this is the year in issue. In year two, he closed the Woodhaven location. He only conducted the fast tax business across town on Camp Bowie Boulevard. Location is identified as an important factor in the fast tax business, the neighborhood that you're dealing with. Probably most importantly, he let Donna Thorley go. He did not do what was necessary to get her to go over to Camp Bowie or attempt to take those customers to Camp Bowie. And perhaps equally a factor is there was very little notice. Mr. Scott himself was a little confused as to when he made the determination not to conduct business at Woodhaven, whether it was in late November, early December, late December, right before the tax season. Of the 199 people that he dealt with the year before, 159 went somewhere else. That's less than the previous year when everything else was the same, but it's still a significant number of people. He only had 40 customers go to Camp Bowie. Mr. Scott says that's because of Donna Thorley's actions. We don't think that the evidence supports that view. There is absolutely no direct evidence from any of these people that went anywhere else as to why they went anywhere else. The only attempt, there was no testimony at trial from any of these people. The only attempt was Mr. Scott's testimony that he sent out 150 surveys asking people why they went somewhere else. Of those, only 7 responses were received. He couldn't recall more than 2. And one of the 2 that he recalled, the response was, too far. Based on that evidence or that survey, and based on Mr. Scott's review of the prior tax returns, who had done them in previous years, he testified that Donna Thorley's action caused all these shifts of the business. It's only circumstantial evidence, and it does not rise to the level of proof. The activities, focusing backwards a little bit, that he's complaining about, once he let Donna Thorley go, Donna first went to Wanda and said, I'd like to go to work for you. Wanda initially said she didn't have any space. At the last minute, something changed. In the latter part of December, Wanda found space for Donna Thorley to make room for her to go. There's no problem. There's nothing in the non-compete that says Donna can't go to work for Marvin and Wanda. And at the same time, the non-compete also does not prevent Wanda Bonney from doing customers' tax returns from Woodhaven. It's just a solicitation. I think this is also undisputed. There's no direct testimony of anything to the contrary, and there's not even any attempt to allege it, but on her own, Donna Thorley sent out letters, approximately 80 letters, of which 30 were returned, which left only 50. She also posted flyers. Judging from the brief, apparently we're talking a 5-day period of time with a holiday included at the end of the year. I believe it was December 28th to January 3rd or 4th, a 1-week period of time. As soon as Wanda found out when some of these envelopes came back, before there was any notice from the Scotts, she told Donna, you can't do that. She hadn't said it previously because the first year when the non-compete was in place, Donna wasn't her employee, wasn't there. She told the other employees, we're not soliciting. They didn't do it. There's no complaint. The following year, frankly, I think it got overlooked until this letter came back, and she said, okay, we can't do this. There's no dispute that at any point after that, there were any attempts to solicit clients. And again, remember, the tax business occurs the following year, some months afterwards. At best, I think this shows an attempted solicitation by Donna Thorley. It doesn't show that it was successful. There is no evidence to show it was successful. Then you go, business did go back to Wanda Bonney's place of business. There were, I hate to even use the number 109 because in my brief I talk about why that's a phantom number to begin with. It's 109 people that were listed on one list and their name showed up on another list. It does not mean 109 customers went from Ed Scott's business to Wanda Bonney's business in that 1 year period of time. If you look at it, it just doesn't make sense. Significant portion of those people were personal friends, relatives of Donna Thorley. What the judgment does is has us believe that those personal friends, those close relations, went to Wanda's place of business to have the tax returns done by Donna Thorley because of solicitation, not because Donna went to Wanda's place of business.
Well, in addition to the circumstantial evidence that you referred us to, what about the testimony of Ed Scott?
If you look at the testimony of Ed Scott, he does say the word caused damages. But when you look at what he used to come to that conclusion, it doesn't fit. The only thing he used, in essence, were the two survey responses that he somewhat recalled. He refers to a survey, but if you send 150 and seven of them respond, you don't even remember more than two, and the only one that you remember of any significance is it was too far. Even though he used the words and relied upon that, there's no basis for it. You don't have to just take the words. In that case, I don't think reasonable minds, that's a situation where, yes, you have the words, but reasonable minds would come to a different conclusion. It doesn't support the judgment.
Well, was there any evidence to the contrary, what he testified to?
That it was caused. There were multiple, because it's circumstantial, there's multiple other reasons
now,
that people
are you
would
saying
go elsewhere.
His direct testimony was circumstantial evidence?
Well, first it was based in hearsay, and then if you look behind just the words that was used, yes, I think it's relying on circumstantial. I don't think that there's nothing to support the opinion that he gave.
Did you make any objection at trial to that effect, that he was not qualified based on background
experience? Did not make an objection at that point during the testimony other than afterwards. Post-trial motions made the point that didn't support. That was no evidence to support it. The other testimony.
And it was no evidence because it was conclusory? Is that essentially what you're saying?
Because even though the words are used, there's no basis behind it. There's no support behind it. He used the words, and he says that relying on a survey, but if you go back behind what was said, and if you even go after the fact, we find out he's relying upon hearsay, but the objection wasn't made at that point in time. But you're looking at maybe one response. Even though he says it, it doesn't satisfy. It doesn't meet it.
But in the context of all the other circumstantial evidence that you've referred to, why wouldn't his testimony along with the circumstantial evidence be enough to meet the burden?
There is no other circumstantial evidence in support of it other than people moved. That's the only thing. People went somewhere else. The prior year, a substantial number of people went somewhere else.
You characterized that evidence as circumstantial earlier in your argument, so that's why I'm using that term.
I think Scott's relying on circumstances to try to establish the fact, and I don't think there is the evidence to support it. Because I don't think the surveys qualify, even though he uses the words. And then what he says is that he reviewed the tax returns from the past to determine who did the returns in the past. Well, all that tells us is who did the returns in the past. It doesn't say why this year they went somewhere else. And the circumstances I'm referring to primarily in the argument are the equally plausible alternative explanations for why people went somewhere else, which is you changed your business, you moved your business, you let the person that did most of the work go. And none of those was refuted or disputed, and if not equally plausible, I think they're more plausible explanations for why people went somewhere else. Again, we're talking about an attempted solicitation with no evidence that it was ever received. Mr. Scott didn't even attempt to establish that. Based on the arguments, we would request that the court reverse and render a take-nothing judgment.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Foster. Mr. Wilkerson.
Please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Meyer, Justice McCoy. I'm Carl Wilkerson here on behalf of the Scotts and CompuQuick Tax and Accounting Services, and I'm also here on behalf of the judgment entered by Judge Curry. We seek to affirm the court's judgment, and we seek to show you that the judgment was supported by legally and factually sufficient evidence. If I may, when this business was sold to the Scotts for $40,000, let me analogize this client list, which was a crux of the business. Obviously, the computers, the software, the desks, the chairs, that wasn't the crux of this business. The crux of this business was this standard client list and all of the income to be derived from this client list. Let me liken that to a vine in a vineyard. The Woodhaven office was a vineyard. This client list was the vine. Each of these names on the client list was the fruit, was the grape. And the juice from each of these grapes was the income to be derived from the vine.
Problem was you tried to pick your vineyard up and move it several miles away to Camp Bowie.
But they had the right to do that because they owned the vine.
But they didn't own the customers. Now, how do you justify the judgment against Mr. Bonney, who didn't sell the business and didn't hire Ms. Thorley nor employ Ms. Thorley?
Mr. Bonney signed a contract not to compete and not to solicit, And even though he did not employ Ms. Thorley,
yes,
we can show that there is conduct that show that he ratified her conduct.
Okay, so you're gonna rely on this ratification argument as to both of them?
Well, there's also direct evidence for the conduct that occurred between December 28th and the January 3rd time period.
Okay, tell me about that evidence as to Mr. Bonney.
Well, the direct evidence is for Ms. Bonney as the employee.
Okay.
The ratification applies for any conduct that occurred before she was formally employed by Ms. Bonney,
okay,
and then for any conduct that occurred after the December 28th time period until she was told not to.
Okay, I'm talking about Mr.
Bonney.
Okay.
By knowing what happened and by retaining the benefits of...
How did he retain the benefits? He didn't own the business.
He did not own the business. The income came into to Ms. Bonney and the Meadowbrook office, and we don't know how Mr. Bonney was compensated.
Okay, well, let me ask you another question.
Counsel, just let me ask one question just before I forget. Just alluding to a question that Justice McCoy had asked earlier in his line, you are relying on ratification, are you not, to support your
direct evidence while she was the employee, again, being the 28th, December 28th to January 3rd time period, and also ratification.
Okay, and I'm looking through the findings of fact and conclusions of law that Judge Curry made. I don't find any findings or conclusions on ratification.
You are correct. The judgment says that they breached the contract by virtue of her conduct. The pleadings raise agency. They raise a respondeat superior, which is a way of saying one person is liable for the conduct of another. Ratification is another theory that's used to impose liability upon one person for the conduct of another.
But in order to support the judgment on that theory, wouldn't you need findings or conclusions of ratification or on that theory?
Not on that specific theory. The judgment can be supported.
How can we know that the judge relied on that theory in reaching his conclusion?
To the extent that ratification is another form of imposing liability upon one person for the conduct of another, the judge can rely on it.
Judge McCoy.
Well, following up on that, before I get to my other point I was going to make, you know, a judgment with a jury, you have a verdict, and so you look at the verdict to see what questions were answered and how they were answered to support the judgment. Ditto on findings of fact and conclusions of law when the judge makes it. You've got to look at that to support the judgment.
Aren't findings of fact, well, in jury questions, aren't jury findings deemed to be found in support of the judgment?
Okay. Well,
if there hasn't been an objection to the absence of such a question?
Let's go ahead. You properly make the point on page 24 of your brief that basically a breach of contract entitles you to lost profits. Well, I think it's unquestioned that this 109 number is wrong, but even if it's not wrong, the $12,546 in profits. That's the gross figure of receipts from the 109 people, assuming it's correct. It's not profit.
How do you
justify that?
It's revenue. We know from the numbers that were provided by the Bonnies in response to the trial court's dictate was here are dollars. And the Bonnies did not make any differentiation.
Not the Bonnies' burden of proof. It's your proof. It's your burden of proof to prove the profit that you lost from the customers that you prove were taken away by Ms. Thorley's actions, if any. And this isn't profit. It's the gross receipts, I believe the testimony was, that these 109 people provided to the Bonnies that were supposedly, you know, supposed to have gone over to the Camp Bowie office.
And I believe that those same numbers don't have to be the profits lost by Mr. Scott. They can be profits that were gained by the Bonnies.
Okay. How did you prove that the gross receipts received by the Bonnies was profit they made?
We didn't prove that it was gross or net or profit. We just proved that those were dollars that the Bonnies received. Juice that the Bonnies received that the Scots did not. And to the extent that was not delineated as gross or net or profits, I believe we're entitled to support the judgment that evidence, you know, just those revenues, those dollars, could be considered as profits absent any evidence to the contrary. The argument that I wish to make is, in a case like this, and I believe it's a principle that, although not expressed in these other cases that we rely upon, the Arabesque, the Chandler case, I believe it underlies those cases. And that is, in a non-compete client list case like this, and I'm sure this court will be presented with others in the future, the breaching party's revenue whether it is gross profits or net profits, from the non-breaching party's clients is a direct damage as a matter of law. Such damage is conclusively presumed to have been foreseen and contemplated by the party as a consequence of his breach. The agreement, the asset purchase agreement that we're dealing with here, specifically ties the non-compete and the juice, the business from these clients. I pointed out the clause where it says, you know, we're warranting and representing that these clients are going to stay with this business, or we don't see any downturn or anything to believe that these clients are going to leave this business. It's the income, it's the juice from these clients that was tied into the $40,000 purchase price. And when, in order to preserve that business, the Bonnies agreed, both Bonnies, Wanda and Marvin Bonnie, agreed, hands off the vine, hands off the grapes, hands off the juice. Now, to the extent some of that juice migrated, I believe was the term used at trial, over to the Bonnies, and that was in year one of the Scott's operation of the Woodhaven Tax Office. To the extent that there were a handful of clients, six or eight, that migrated over, somehow some of that juice wound up in the Bonnies' vat, there's no complaint. Why? Because there was no solicitation. But the following year, after Donna Thorley conducted this solicitation, and because of the Bonnies' failure to counsel her or advise her not to do the solicitation, and their retention of the benefits from that solicitation, they were liable for her conduct, and indeed Mrs. Bonney was liable for her conduct that occurred while she was Mrs. Bonney's employee from December 28th to January 3rd, and the evidence showed that during that time period we have postmarked letters that were postmarked on or after that date, that flyers went out, and that phone calls were made.
Let me go back to damages for a minute. The $12,546 is based on the 109 customers, and the 109 customers is wrong as a matter of fact on its face, because at least there's duplications in the list. How can the $12,546 be correct?
The $12,546 could be a number that was acquired or a compromise by the fact finder from the $40,000+ that was evidenced by Mr. Scott when he extrapolated the loss of that income.
The $12,546 was exactly the amount of money paid by the 109 people.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And to the extent that there were a few dollars that shouldn't have been included in that specific list, perhaps there were a few dollars that should be added, to the extent that those people were not going to come back to Mr. Scott's business as he testified to.
Do you think really the truth here is that the customers didn't leave the business left the customers and moved to Camp Bowie?
The truth here is that but for the solicitation of those customers, we would have a much harder case to prove. Had there been no solicitation of these customers, then we would be arguing pure inference. When 109 grapes of clients show up in their vat a year after the fact, and we have no evidence of solicitation, then our hands are tied and we're purely arguing circumstance and inference. And in that situation, it would be difficult to sustain this judgment. But because of this breach and the solicitation, and let me point out, there is a document that was in evidence that specifically identified that I called it the
solicitation list, and that is Plaintiff's Exhibit 20. And that document recites, client list as of 4-5-2007, that Donna sent letters, and they came to Meadowbrook for Donna to prepare 2006 income taxes.
I contend that that argument also provides direct evidence of the link between the solicitation and the revenue gained by the Bonnies as a result of that solicitation. So we're not just arguing circumstances here. And thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Foster.
Yes, Your Honor. Just addressing the last point. Just addressing the last point first, the letter that he was referring to, there is still no connection. That was provided during the discovery, and the reason we provided it is because we wanted to try to find the ones that we potentially had solicitation. Those are people that went to Bonnie, yes. Those are people that a letter was sent to, yes. Actually, one of the people on that list, the letter is actually in the 30 that came back, so it didn't even get received. There's still no proof of a causal connection between any letters that were sent and any of the customers that went from, well, you can't go from the Woodhaven location because it's not there, but that went to the Meadowbrook location. Addressing a point that was raised earlier as far as the direct evidence of causation, the testimony of Mr. Scott, this is his answer, because their solicitation of our customers caused them to go to the Meadowbrook office. The only thing that was said, the only statement, the only word caused, the only thing cited by counsel in support of that. During the cross-examination, in trying to find out the support behind that, and we go through the people, part of the questions, this is on page 69 of volume 2, we were going through the numbers, I went through the 109, the numbers left and whatever, and we're talking about the people that did not go back. And the question was, where did those people go? I don't know. Why did they go? I don't know. Didn't you talk to any of them, did you? No. Wouldn't have a clue? No. There's nothing to support the statement that was made earlier. His own testimony refutes what he tried to establish for causation. Even as to the only thing he comes up with on the 109, again, is that survey response, which doesn't support his causation testimony either. Addressing a few final issues, the $12,546 figure that was discussed, even Mr. Scott at trial conceded that number wasn't accurate, that some things had to be subtracted off of it. And I think that's one of the points where we're all focusing and we're listening and the judge hears it, but the spoken word is different and maybe the connection wasn't made, and I'll take the blame for not drawing the connection. But the testimony of Mr. Scott, the concession at trial, doesn't even support the award that the judge granted.
The concession being that he didn't know why the customers went.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I've switched to a different position. When we were talking about the damages, Mr. Scott had initially in discovery and such come up with $12,546, and I believe that was Paige Lewicki's report. During the discussion about that, at trial, he conceded that number was not accurate. He conceded that he should not be able to recover for the personal friends that went there because they went because of a personal relationship, not any solicitation. Six people that are on that list didn't even go to Mr. Scott the first year that he purchased the business when there was no support. He conceded those should not have been on the list. Yet they were on the report because it was just a comparison of one set of names to another set of names, two different years.
Hey, back on the cause issue, you've got the solicitation letter and you've got the customers going to this location. And you say that's not enough to show that the solicitation caused them to go to that location. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so what would be enough? It sounds as if you're saying the only way that they could prove causation in this situation would be if the customers themselves said that the reason I went there was because I got this letter.
I would assume that there is a statistical study that could be done that could be supported where you could send a survey that perhaps did inquire as to why people went. I would think at the very least I would have offered direct testimony from somebody saying the reason they went there was because they received a letter, or that they at least received a letter. Do they have to get each of those customers in? I don't know that that's required. I think there are ways you could do it if, in fact, that was required. And I do think there are other statistical studies that could have been done to establish it, but it wasn't done. It wasn't even attempted. This isn't even junk science. This is just someone with a reason to make a statement based on one survey saying some words to try to get a judgment. And that is not evidence. Again, we would request that the court, as to the ratification, it wasn't pled, wasn't raised at trial. Request that the court reverse and render. Thank you.
After this judgment is entered, have y'all picked the phone up and tried to talk to each other about this? Just a thought.
I understand, and I'm really trying to recall if we had any discussions whatsoever
just
with trial counsel.
Food for thought.
Understand, Your Honor.
We'll see if it'll grow.
Mr. Foster, Mr. Wilkerson, thank you both for appearing here this morning. We appreciate your arguments. The case is submitted. You're both excused.